what's this zombie thing you do? What are you doing? Man, I asked the right question.
This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 65, recorded live on Wednesday, May 8th, 2013. I am Joel Duggan, and Peyton Francis, my podcasting partner in crime, is absent this evening. He had some family stuff he had to take care of. But joining us is Lou Page from Zombies Ate My Podcast, returning to the Citadel Cafe. Welcome back, my friend.
Thanks for having me. Always glad to be here.
Always our pleasure to have you, sir. Thoroughly enjoy all the unique things that you bring to the podcast. You know some things in the deep, dark corners of the internet that I would never even know where to look for. So
always, that's kind of my specialty.
There you go. There you go. And speaking of deep, dark things, I mean, your podcast is not exactly the cheeriest of podcasts. You talk about zombies.
We talk about zombies, but we try to make it fun.
Okay.
You have to make it fun.
You have to make it fun. Blood and gore and brains dripping out your nose. Woohoo!
Exactly.
So you were just mentioning actually in the preamble here that you guys have had some guests on the show recently, which is something that I've been trying to do a lot more with the Citadel Cafe to kind of keep it fresh, keep it interesting. So who have you guys had on?
So there was our first guest was Brian Dunaway, your co-host.
Oh, yeah. Right on.
And he did a zombie short, and we had him on to talk about that and the director of the zombie short. And then we had someone reach out to us and ask if we wanted to interview them.
No kidding.
And it was a guy that was doing a Kickstarter over in England for a set of zombie mugs and beer steins. And so we interviewed him, and that was kind of a little nerve-wracking because we know Brian, so it was easy to talk to him.
Right.
But it was like we reached out to this total stranger that reached out to us, and we were like, sure, we'll interview you. And then we had Kim Price on a couple weeks ago to talk about her Zombie Nista blog.
Oh, right. That's right.
And last night, and what will be going up tonight or tomorrow morning, is we interviewed an author about his zombie book called Zombies of Byzantine. I can never pronounce this word right, but the Byzantine Empire.
Oh, okay.
And it's basically a fiction novel that takes place during the middle of the Byzantine Empire, and a zombie outbreak happens. And the emperor is torn between fighting the zombies and fighting off the waves of barbarians.
Oh, wow.
So,
how can you tell the difference?
Exactly. but that was interesting because he's also a history professor.
Oh, wow. So like, some seriously
accurate
stuff.
We felt
like
we were learning stuff while we were talking to him. Afterwards, I think Ryan and I both agreed that we were like, wow, I kind of feel dumb, but
yeah.
Okay, we made it work.
It's always really nice to have really intelligent people to interview. Several of the guests, I shouldn't say several, most of the guests on Comics Coast to Coast, which I do with Brian Dunaway, are always, I mean, they're just comic nerds, right? Because they're comic creators. So everybody always has a slightly different way of doing things, or this super cool, you know, color tutorial blog that they swear by that you've never heard of. And several of the people that we've had on lately have been extraordinarily, I don't want to say gifted, but just packed with knowledge about what their little corner of the internet is and how they are making their craft better. And it has made me feel like, How did I not know this? Like, I've been doing this for years. How did I not know about this resource or that resource or this blog or that blog? And I mean, everybody knows the majors, you know, like DeviantArt, Tumblr, et cetera. But when you have somebody that's, you know, doing something else in a different region, and then you say, oh, well, we've got this little mini group on this mini group site, and you should seek out some of your peers on this group. And you're just like, son of a bitch. Like, it's this is the kind of stuff that you want, because, I mean, quickly, you know, a Facebook group turns into noise. You know, we do a pretty good job, I feel, on the webcomics community on Google+, by keeping it to conversation-based posts. I liberally delete posts where people are just like, here's my comic, and I axe it. It's not what the group is about. It's more about people saying, hey, I'm going to a con this weekend. It's my first time, you know, what should I bring with me? Or, interviews or YouTube videos for techniques and stuff. And it's turned into a really, really valuable community, but it's so hard to maintain stuff as it grows, right?
And I agree with you completely.
Yeah, and I imagine, like, with the topic as popular as zombies, with, we'll say nerds, like you and I both are,
yeah.
It must be difficult to find, you know, nice places to hang out and chat online about the movies and the video games and the stuff that you're into without getting kind of bombarded by people that are just making noise.
Oh, yeah, it's really noisy. I tried doing a Google Plus zombies community, like, there's a default one, and I joined that, and it's really just people posting the same, like, stuff every week, and it's
animated,
like,
GIFs and stuff, yeah.
I don't want to put my stuff in there and get lost in the noise.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could always start a Zombies Ate My Podcast group.
We've actually toyed with the idea, so
yeah, I mean,
think that's going to end up happening.
It's fairly easy. I mean, like, as a group creator, I get emails in my inbox every time someone posts, and I can quickly scan it, decide whether I need to check it out, whether it interests me. The great news is that right now we've got over 400, 500 members, I think. I don't know if we've hit 5. I know we've hit 4. And it kind of self-manages. Like, I only really have to police the really blatant kind of, like, look at my stuff posts.
Right.
Everybody else, if it's a post where someone's like, hey, I'm a new person in the group, I'm introducing myself, here's what I'm doing, here's a link to some of the artwork I'm doing, I'm having a problem with drawing hands, or whatever it is they want to ask about. Sometimes there are much more advanced questions than that, but that's just an example. I don't have to, because I used to feel when there was only 20 people in the group that I should answer, because I was the guy that started it, and I'm part of this podcast, and it would just be the thing to do. But now that there's so many people, like, 30 seconds later, somebody nice replies. So the conversations and the help happens communally now, which is wonderful. So it's really worked out well. You guys might get a kick out of it, especially if you're looking for content for the show. If you use it as a venue for, like, look, you know, you have to listen to the show to know what we've already talked about. And if you, you know, are going to submit stuff and it's new to us, then, like, this would be a great place to do it. And that way you guys don't have to worry about, like, email and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. The craziest thing we learned is when we started the idea of talking about zombies every week, we were like, are we going to have enough content every week? And believe it or not, there is lots of zombie news every week.
I can imagine.
We have to personally thank the American CDC, because literally, like, it's like every other week we have a news article where the CDC practices a zombie outbreak somewhere in the country. And it's like, like, really? This is crazy.
That's awesome. That's really funny.
There was even a military, one week we talked about a military practice drill they did in, like, Hawaii, where they practiced a zombie outbreak with the Marines.
Wow.
And I was like, this is kind of frightening.
Yeah.
That's not normal.
And that, I mean, that brings me back to what you talked about with your history professor that you guys had on. I mean, his research and his knowledge would make his story feel very real if he was writing about zombies and the, what period of time did you say it was?
The Byzantine Empire.
Byzantine, yeah.
It's 700 AD.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, stuff like that. I mean, with someone that knowledgeable, then dipping into fantasy, it's almost like, it's like those Michael Crichton books, like, you know, Jurassic Park, other things that he's done, like Prey was very good. And, you know, he's done his research. He's a very intelligent guy. He's a very knowledgeable guy because he speaks with, you know, professionals in these fields of science. And he just tweaks it just a little bit. Like, he doesn't go way sci-fi, you know, like, you know, 2025 Star Trek. He just kind of, like, pushes it. What if this technology advanced 20 years, but it happened, like, next month? Like, what would happen? And it really feels like it feels feasible. And I would imagine that having some sort of, like, zombie twisted barbarian war, if you knew enough about history, like if you knew enough about the Byzantine Empire, you could probably make that feel very real.
Yeah. Like, I guess the reason he picked this period, we gathered from the interview, was there was not a lot of history on the actual people, so he could kind of had leeway with giving them personality and stuff.
That makes sense.
And the basic gist of, I've actually bought the book right after we did the interview and started reading. And the basic gist is, it's like there's a monk who's on a journey and he paints idols for the Byzantine Empire. And there's like a village they come to and there's a zombie outbreak. And they manage to get away with their lives. And the first thing they do is, we got to go tell the emperor, because these zombies are coming from the south and the barbarians are coming from the north. And the basic gist of the novel is the emperor wants to use the zombies to fight the barbarians. And it all goes horribly wrong.
Nice. Nice, nice. Now, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I sent you a link earlier on Twitter last week, maybe, for X Heroes, which is a similar vein, except for it's a futuristic zombie apocalypse story with superheroes.
Right. I looked at the link and I added the book to my Amazon wish list.
Right. Now, and that to me also feels like, you know, you're taking something that people know very, very well, the superhero meme, you're putting a zombie spin on it. And, you know, you're, again, because the superhero, I guess, genre, for lack of a better term, is so familiar to people, then that would be a very easy thing to springboard from.
Exactly. When I heard way back when Marvel was doing their zombies thing, I was really interested until I started reading it, and I was kind of like, oh.
That to me really seemed like a trope.
It was really tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
To the point where it was kind of ridiculous, and I was like, oh, this isn't what I was hoping it would be.
Yeah. Well, it's neat to see how, even though, I mean, I'm going to admit that I'm kind of sick of the whole zombie thing. I'm not a big fan of zombie movies, so that's my, I guess, my two cents. But it is kind of cool to see it in, like, examples like this X-Heroes, examples like the book that you're talking about. What was the name of it?
Zombies of Byzantinium.
Okay. So with Zombies of Byzantinia, with X-Heroes, like, there are some cases where it's being used correctly, or well, I guess not correctly, but it's not so tropey as it is like a real pivotal part of the story, as opposed to just like, you know, yay, zombies are popular, let's make zombie race cars, you know, just...
Exactly. I mean, I will admit up front, I do a zombies podcast, so obviously I am a huge zombies fan.
Oh, I know you're a fan.
But
I'm not
joking. But there was a while there where even I was kind of like, okay, can we move on? Can we stop with this stuff? Okay.
Yeah.
It's more tropes. Okay, everybody's doing a B-zombie movie. They're not funny anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I see the same sort of things in animation. You know, like, I mean, you see a really good show, like a 3D animated show, and it happens to be toon shaded. You know, it looks kind of like Borderlands or whatever.
Right.
And it's cool, it's graphic, and it all sort of fits. Well, then the network knuckleheads at Cartoon Network or wherever decide to make every freaking show they have, or every new show they have, look just like this new show that's all got everybody up and praising it on the internet. And, you know, it's like, well, that doesn't work. Like, you can't just slap toon shading or zombies or whatever your you know, insert meme, you know, angry cat or grumpy cat, whatever it is. It doesn't work for everything. You know, like, I mean, it might be funny for a skit on Saturday Night Live if it's like ironic or something, but not in the grand scheme of things, you know? And I find that zombies had hit that point, you know, several examples withstanding, like Walking Dead and some other things.
Right.
Where they were kind of saturating the market to the point where it wasn't cool anymore. Like, it just kind of got yesterday on me.
I will be honest, and I don't even think I've admitted this on the podcast, but even when they started season 3 of Walking Dead, like, I needed the show to keep me going, because I was kind of at the end of season 2, I was kind of like, okay, so we're going to get really depressed again. This is going to be really depressing.
Yeah.
Come on, I need to drag my feet. Come on.
Yeah, I have a really, really hard time getting in the mood to sit down and watch The Walking Dead. I like it. I like it when I'm watching it, but it makes me very anxious. It makes me very uncomfortable.
I will admit, this past season, I started out that way for like the first 3 episodes, and then all of a sudden it hits its stride about episode 4, and it was like, oh no, I really want to watch more.
Right. Right. I mean, and it's not, and it's not like I don't like it. Like, I mean, I do want to see what happens and I'm interested in it, but it just, it's one of those things where like, I've just had a really long day. I don't know if I really want to be stressed out for the next 45 minutes. You know, like I kind of want to watch, you know, reruns of Smallville or something, you know, Superman wrapped in Dawson's Creek. That's what I need right now.
Exactly.
Oh man. Well, I guess, if you haven't guessed, folks, with all the talk about zombies and stuff, we are a nerdy podcast. We talk about everything from sci-fi, fantasy to, everything in between. If it's amazing and we think it's worth sharing, we will share it. If we think it's bunk, we will also poo-poo it and let you know on the show to avoid it at all costs. This is normally a podcast with three chairs, but right now it's just Lou and I. I think we will be. I think we'll be okay.
I think so.
We'll hold on like in a zombie apocalypse. You know, I'll grab the machete. What do you want?
I have a baseball bat in the corner.
Sweet. Okay, cool. I got the blade. You got the blunt. It's all good. We cover all kinds of things from sci-fi, websites, books, apps, all that kind of stuff. So one of the cool things, though, that we've been doing recently has been talking about one of our favorite fantasy television shows, yours and mine, Game of Thrones. And this is, of course, where I warn all of you that we are about to spoil the crap out of season 3. So episode 6, The Climb, is our topic for Winter's Coming season 3 this week, and we are going to spoil it. So if you haven't seen it, pause the show. We won't mind. Come back later. If you have seen it, buckle up, because Lou and I are going to chit-chat about this week's episode, which was dark.
There were some good
points, which I think we can probably save the best for last. But there are a lot of little nods here and there. As I mentioned, the episode is called The Climb. In King's Landing, Tywin Lannister coerces with Orlena Tyrell into agreeing to marrying Loras to Cersei. Sansa tries to get acquainted with an awkward Loras while Tyrion and Cersei discuss repercussions of their matches. Neither one of them are very happy about that. Sansa gets bad news. Roz gets really bad news. Joffrey was barely in it, but what little he has is epic. And what else is going on? There is a little bit at the table for Rob and his would-be kingdom in the north.
The Lannister boys get killed, his prisoners.
That was last week.
Was that last week?
Yeah, that was last week.
It's a blur. Sorry.
It's okay. No, it's fine. Worth mentioning again. That was a rough go. we were surprised that happened. What else happens? Oh, there's a conversation between the spider and Littlefinger. And of course, there's a lot happening north of the wall, or actually not so much north of the wall, on the wall. So John is returned to the wall. So where do you want to start?
I'll start wherever you want.
Okay. Well, let's get Sam and Gilly out of the way, because I enjoy some of the developments that Sam's character takes, and I'm liking the way that they're handling it in the show. It's not as whiny in the books. The books, he is a fraidy cat for far longer. And he's harder to take, but I really enjoy it in the show. But the one thing that I found very interesting, which I guess could be a product of Gilly's, I guess, life as a wife of Craster, is that she's very demanding and she just wants what she wants now that she's free. And she, no sooner does Sam say he can't sing, he's not very good at it, he doesn't necessarily want to sing, she just looks at him kind of goes, "Sing a song for me." Because she knows that he likes her. And I'm just like, that's obnoxious. Like, just poor Sam.
Well, her character in the book is kind of annoying, too. So I really wasn't surprised.
Well, she's absolutely clueless, yeah.
Yeah, she's not one of my favorite characters. Though I really like Sam.
Me too.
He's one of my favorite characters. When I first get introduced to him, I was like, he's going to be really annoying. But not so much, actually. He's actually smart. Yeah, he's clever.
Yeah, he has that balance of being a whimpering idiot. Well, not a whimpering idiot, but like a whimpering scaredy cat.
Right.
But also being a very intelligent man with good intentions. All of the other intelligent people, like really intelligent people in the world, tend to be evil. Like Tywin Lannister. Tyrion isn't all that evil. He kind of swings both ways, but he's still very, very intelligent and still playing on the wrong side. Like, he's on the bad guy side of the fence.
Right.
And what else? Who else is there that's really... Well, like Littlefinger. It varies. He kind of... I don't know which side he's on. He's kind of on his own side.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's kind of his own beast.
Yeah, kind of smack in the middle. But everybody that's really extraordinarily intelligent and you are smacked in the face with that intelligence are usually the bad guys in the story thus far. So it's nice to see that in Sam, that he's pretty smart. And there's a little bit of foreshadowing, too, that happens in that scene, too, where he's talking about the dragon glass, the obsidian blade that he has. And I'm excited to see where that goes because, you know, we still in the show haven't seen Sam fight.
Right.
You know, like he pushed and shoved his way free to grab Jilly and run from Craster's when it was all going sour. But I don't think he actually hit anybody.
No, but when he does, I think we're in for a show.
I think it's going to be an interesting spectacle. It's not going to be... what's the word I'm looking for? I don't think it's going to be something cheap or accidental.
No.
Like how Arya kind of got her first stab in like the stable boy with her sword. Like I don't know if it's going to be like that. So I'm curious to see how it handles it. I'm realizing now that I think you and I have both read the book, so I don't want to spoil anything ahead for our listeners because some people I'm sure are just listening, just watching the show. But yeah, it's gonna be a lot of fun. So pay attention, people. Pay attention to the direct class. That's all I'll say. It's gonna be a good season, I think, for all that kind of stuff. Moving on to the Brothers Without Banners. I'm gonna split hairs here, and I don't recall this scene at all from the book.
Okay, I'm glad you say that because that was kind of mine and my wife's whole opinion when we watched this. Was I don't remember any of this. Yeah, I don't remember Dondarrion sending off the blacksmith kid with Melisandre. I don't remember any of that. I thought he stayed with them. So it's nice to see that they're doing something different. I'm just not sure what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that, I mean, I would imagine, as with Walking Dead, which we mentioned earlier in the show, that the writer and creator of Walking Dead is involved in the TV show, as is, I'm sure, George Martin is involved with the writing of the Game of Thrones TV show. And it's a fluid medium. I mean, just because you wrote it in the book doesn't mean it has to happen in the same order in the television show.
Right.
So we might be getting snippets of the story that either happened and hit the editing room floor or didn't happen at all, but always wished they could have happened, or it would make sense that they happened. Like, I do know that Melisandre leaves Stannis and she heads north. And I know that eventually Gendry and Arya part ways. So both of those things are true to form so far in the series. So it makes sense that she would have to go through the Riverlands to get where she's going. What I did like about it though was the kind of the reveal that Thoris of Myr and Melisandre both speak High Valyrian, which, as we found out a couple episodes ago, is also the mother tongue for Daenerys. So I'm starting to see this whole kind of web weave together where you've got the Targaryens, which are, you know, born of fire and very in with interwoven with dragons in their history. Then you've got this R'hllor, the Lord of Light. High Valyrian is all kind of spoken together. You've got these priests and priestesses of the Red God. Like, and it's really starting to meld. Like, just like in real life, where you've got, you know, something like Christianity that is divided into many different sections. I feel like because Westeros is old, that you've got this, you know, Red God and his religion, and possibly like the seven gods, the old gods, or the seven new gods, or whatever in Westeros, and again they're subdivided, and it's just that it's been so freaking long since any of this ever started that people are forgetting that, you know, they're, even though they're two warring factions, they might have the same roots as far as their religion and their beliefs and stuff go.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's really cool to see that kind of like coming together in these tiny little threads that if you're not paying attention, that you kind of miss. And I did like that about the scene, but everything else, Jocelyn and I were the same thing. We were sitting on the couch kind of bewildered, kind of going, I don't know what's going on, but yeah, let's just watch and see where it goes.
In the book, they do a good job of kind of making you realize that Dondarrion coming back to life as many times as he has is not a normal coincidence. Mm. But they kind of used, I think they used the scene really to kind of beat it into the audience that they should be surprised by what happened, not and expect some twist about it.
Later. Right. Yeah. No, and because Melisandre was shocked. She's like, how the hell, you drunken idiot, do you have this power?
Exactly.
You know? And of course, Thoris was like, it's not my power. It's the Lord's power. I just, you know, I'm just wielding it because, and I mean, they chalked it down to the origin of Dondarrion, which was he died at the hands of the Hound or the Mountain. I can't remember which. I want to say the Mountain.
The Mountain.
Yeah. Had a lance through his heart at a tournament. And so because Thoris loved him, because he was his friend, he begged the Lord to bring it back, and it worked. And it was just like the purest, simplest thing, where previous to that, Thoris was basically done with it. He thought he didn't believe anymore, you know, like he wasn't doing his duties. And I thought that that was a really interesting kind of like shake to Thoris and his lack of faith, but also to Melisandre, who is doing all of these things kind of like by the book and has all these grandiose plans. And this one guy with too much rum, you know, just decides to just like, nah, I want to bring my friend back to life. So I did.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. They in the book, they don't do a good job of explaining that to you.
No.
I think the show did a way better job of it.
I absolutely agree. I feel something, there's something to do with Martin getting too wordy in the books on things that don't need it. And then you get lost with what the original point was.
Right,
where there's a lot that can be said for the dialogue that's exchanged between the actors, but then like the surprised or shocked looks where they're held for a long time and like that kind of stuff kind of sinks in, where you can still listen to the details of the story of Thoris, you know, in the tournament and how he brought him back and how he's brought him back several times. But to hear that over Melisandre going up to Dondarrion, putting her hands on his face and inspecting him and seeing all the different scars that he received, that visual is enough to kind of really drive it home.
Right.
Yeah, so I think they did a good job there. What are your feelings on Jon Snow?
Jon is one of my favorite characters in the story. I love every time something focuses on Jon. Ygritte, though, is one of my least favorite characters.
Dude, you and I are of the same ilk. Same ilk. I joked around with Smallville and Dawson's Creek earlier, but I really feel there were some stupid moments in this episode with Jon and Ygritte. Like, I don't even think it's the actor. Like, I don't want to, because I mean, everybody in the show can act circles around me, man. Like, it's not that. It's, I don't think I ever believed in her in the book.
No, I don't think I did either. And seeing her act, it's like, oh yeah, she does a great job. I just don't like the character.
Yeah, I don't like the motivation. Like, it just, he captures her and he almost kills her. And then while he's got her strung up and is taking her to wherever he's going, she tries to snuggle up and sleep with him the whole freaking time she's there. Like, I mean, I get that she's trying to escape and stuff, but nothing would ever, I mean, you know, in any of this kind of stuff, you try to put yourself into the character. Like, you try to become Jon Snow. What would I do if I was Jon Snow? Would I do the same sort of things that he does? And that's kind of how you end up judging people's, you know, more characters' moralities in books. And I'm just like, I would never fall for that.
No.
You know?
Even at his age, I would have been like, if you mess with me anymore, I'm going to just kill you and be done with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and we know that his father was Ed Stark, but come on, like, that would test my patience to the extreme.
Exactly. I would have just said, okay, I'm going to leave you tied up and I'm going to leave you here in the snow. Good luck.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Have fun with that. Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot of moments in this episode where they're sharing these loving glances and these loving embraces, and it is completely lost on me. Like, I'm just drumming my fingers on the coffee table waiting for it to be over. You know, when I was watching it the other day, I like some of the overall scenes that they were in, not because it was them, but because of what they were doing, you know, climbing the wall, seeing the world from the top of the wall, again, ignoring Jon and Ygritte and just focusing on, like, you know, the first time you get to see a clearer view from up there. I thought that was really cool. I mean, they showed it in the first season, but I mean, it's the first time in a while that we've been up on top of the wall.
Right. They don't do it all the time. So you don't really, you forget how large that wall is.
Yeah, well, and there's I mean, there's one shot, I think, looking up at it, and then another shot from the top of it, but it's like cloudy in winter, and right. another one's at night. So you don't necessarily get a really sunny day that I remember until this episode. Correct me if I'm wrong, but
no, I think you're right. I think you're right.
You know, and especially a clear day off both sides. Like usually the scenes are shorter, so you're only really looking one way or the other. And to see both sides kind of struck me as
you see where the snow ends and where the snow begins. That's for sure.
Yeah. And I did notice that. And it made me wonder, like, if winter is coming and the snow is moving south, how come the snow at the wall hasn't, like, I mean, snow is airborne. Like, it's just, you know, snowing at the wall. I'm wondering why it hasn't crept down farther past the wall. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself.
I'm not sure. I think this winter is coming thing has always been a kind of weird thing with the Game of Thrones.
Mm.
Because in the book, it's just like winter comes and winter's for 5 years, or winter can be for 7 years, or winter can be for a year. And it's like, plant rotations don't work like that.
Monster plants from Game of Thrones. Yeah, they migrate and hibernate, and they're as big as bears.
Well, I mean, planets, like whatever world they're on.
Oh, planets. I thought you said plants.
No, planets. No.
My mind has been on Plants vs. Zombies since the start of the show.
Ah, okay. But yeah, when a planet rotates, the science behind it is just kind of murky.
Yeah, no, I agree. I feel like something they did with the title sequence, too, is that to really separate Westeros from any kind of world that we know, it feels like Westeros isn't a globe. It feels like it's a concave circling right. the sun.
It might have to be.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I feel like that's kind of... I know it's a strange way to look at it, and the science is completely busted, but, you know, like, you're dealing with a world where there's dragons. Maybe it's not a planet, you know? Maybe it's some sort of mystical realm. I don't know. Yeah, which is cool. Like, I like that... I do kind of like that some of those questions are unanswered. And the thing is that they're grave enough when they're talking about winter and the five-year-long winters that you just kind of buy it.
Yeah, you know that when it comes, it's rough.
Yeah, the old people are scared. Like they don't dig it.
Yeah, like it's so funny to hear the young people. They're like, oh yeah, I remember last winter. I was little, and it's like, yeah, I don't think you realize what was going on when last winter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what did they say? They say that the summer, I guess, had lasted 7 years.
Right. Yeah. And all the kids are teenagers, so the last time they saw winter, they were like 3, 4, 5.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, that makes sense. So while they were climbing the wall, some crazy stuff happened with the wall weeping and cracking and shedding itself, because it's kind of the natural defenses of having an ice wall that high. And I thought they did an epic job of making that feel pretty scary.
Yeah. As I was watching them climb, I was like, I remember reading this in the book, but I wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
This doesn't seem like a good idea. What person in their right mind would try and climb that?
Yeah, I mean, 700 feet straight up. Like, there didn't appear to be any kind of ledge or, you know, until that piece fell off, there was nothing to actually stand on.
Right.
You know, and I mean, also made some clear motivations for the warg. I can't remember his name right now, but I mean, he was trying to cut them loose before he really had to. He was anxious to do that. I mean, that to me, I mean, that man would get a dagger in the gut the moment he wasn't looking.
Yeah, when they get to the top of the wall and they just kind of like, oh yeah, I was like, no, he would have gotten thrown off.
Yeah, well, and that was the other thing. It's like, you know, they get to the top of the wall. They're all relieved. They're all exhausted. And now she's looking off the top of the wall and she's mesmerized by it. And then there's this long embrace and they're looking into each other's eyes. And I'm thinking in my head, like, the whole time, someone tried to kill you. How do you not see that? How are you not pissed off? I mean, John's got a short temper. I mean, how is he strung up with regret as opposed to having this war guy on the ground with a knife to his throat going, I know what you did. Try it again and it'll be the end of you. Like, just...
Exactly.
The motivation behind Ygritte and all that kind of stuff is just cloudy for me. It really kind of messed with that whole scene, unfortunately.
I think they're trying to make John the heartthrob for the girls. Think that's kind of what they're trying to do, is I think they're trying to sell him as a love interest to keep girls interested.
Yeah, I don't know. He's not exactly very...
No.
Not suave at all.
Not
He's
at
got all.
All
those same moves that Sam has, for Pete's sake. Oh, well, speaking of someone who is not a heartthrob, Theon, something that has been brought up in this household quite often, not only do we not like Theon, we don't like how Theon looks. I think it's quite funny. Whenever he's on screen, just because he's a bad guy and people don't like him, Jocelyn doesn't like him, but she really finds him unattractive.
Well, that, and if you look up his picture on IMDb, it doesn't even look like the same guy. They do something with his makeup and his hair for the show that makes him look like an even bigger sleazeball than he's probably
got
normally
that sleazy feel, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He has no good vibes coming off him whatsoever. And I mean, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your point of view, he is getting his due after sacking Winterfell and killing some of our favorite characters. Man, oh man, like. Just similar to The Walking Dead, something that they do very, very well is they leave your imagination to do the dirty work. And they do some very simple effects here where Roose Bolton's... I don't remember. They haven't revealed who he is.
No,
but he knows where he knows that he's a Bolton. Like, he figured that out in this episode, so that's not a spoiler.
Right.
But... They show him cutting his finger and like torturing him and continuing to mess with his mind and break him down. And they just show the knife going in. They show him slicing in different places so you know what's going to happen. And then he starts. And they just should have showed the tip of him peeling the skin off the guy's finger, off Theon's finger. And then they just cut to a wide angle of the guy screaming and writhing. And your brain just completes the rest of the picture. And I mean, I was on the edge of my seat. I was just squirming and...
Welcome to the school of Hitchcock.
Oh, yeah?
That's kind of Hitchcock's motif for his films, was he used to give you a little bit, just enough to let you know that something bad was going to happen, and then let the imagination fill in.
Yeah. Yeah,
because your imagination is 10 times worse than anything they could show you.
Oh my God, I guess it is. Well, and especially keep on going back to the books, but having read the books, having known what happens and what more happens in graphic detail, like, I didn't have very far to leap before I was able to complete the picture. Like,
I don't think the next time we see Theon, he's going to be in a whole bunch of piece.
Yeah, there's some nasty things that are in store for him, I think. And it sucks I'm trying to think about how to say this without spoiling anything. It's really hard. Maybe I should just not say anything.
Yeah, why don't we leave it at that?
Yeah, I'll keep my mouth shut. Because again, like, it's hard with you on the show because
I've read everything.
I know you've read everything. And Peyton hasn't. And when he's on the show, it's a constant reminder. And I know that some of our listeners haven't read the books, but I can't hear you guys. So it's tempting to just kind of get into this whole like total nerd fest with Lou to just talk about Game of Thrones. But we'll have to do it later. Oh man. Well, I guess I don't know. What's your favorite scene from the show, man? What do you want to talk about?
Let's go with Rob.
Rob? Okay. Tell me why. I'm surprised. Fill me in.
Well, I'm just surprised at how much Rob is in the show in general. Because, not to go back to the books, but, and it won't spoil anything, but in the books, I don't remember any chapters ever being in his perspective.
No, they're all from his mom's.
They're all from his mom's, or they're from an uncle or somebody that's a friend that's a regular chapter character. And it's like you never see Rob do anything and it be from his perspective. So every time they do a scene with him, I'm like, I remember this stuff being discussed in the book, but I don't remember any of this being unfolding like this. But so his parts always leave me confused.
Hmm. See, I really like Rob scenes, and I think maybe it's because I liked Rob in the books and I wanted more of him, and I could only ever get him through his mother's eyes or through his uncle's eyes. And I like kind of where it went. I feel like he's kind of painted himself into a corner, unfortunately.
Yeah.
The way that they're doing it in the show. And again, like with this kind of stuff, these kind of details being told so differently in the books, I don't remember them. So it's new to me watching it in the show. And I feel like the big, I guess, epiphany from the scene with Rob at his table there was that no matter what happens, no matter how much war and death and fighting is going on, everybody is just playing politics. Like everybody wants to marry quick for favor and power. It seems to be the only thing that will actually hold any worth to people.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Like they all want to be interbred together so that they can mingle with each other and make deals that they wouldn't be able to get otherwise.
Yeah. Well, I mean, cause they want grandchildren as leverage, you know, like, I mean, if two kids marry and have kids, then, you know, Lord A can go to Lord B. It's like, well, for the good of our grandchildren, we have to do this. And then everybody's twisted into doing what whoever has the more troops or the more power or whatever. And it just, it's, yeah, it, I mean, it's snaky and it's old school, but it seems to be strangely wildly and widely accepted by even good, smart people like Rob. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I know he skipped out on his arranged marriage and he married somebody else, but like he's very quick to realize this is his only choice and is forcing his uncle into it. And it's just like, I don't know, man, like it feels strange to me to have this guy that's doing all these battle tactics then now trying to play matchmaker. Like, you know, it's weird.
That, and it also makes you realize how much like his father he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true.
Like, in the book, you never get that. I feel like they kind of ponder around the point that he's a lot like his father, but in the show, they force feed it to you that he's just like his father. He's just like his father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everything is honor. Everything is, he needs to do the right thing.
Yeah, well, he certainly plays by the book for the most part, especially when it comes to like atoning for his mistakes, which he seems to reiterate quite a bit in the scene, or scenes,
yeah.
I guess, where he's talking about, you know, like he's screwed up, he's insulted the phrase, and I have to now make amends for my wrongdoings. And just like, dude, it's just like, you married someone that you wanted to marry. Like, it's so funny how this is such a big insult and how people are waving the words around of this old, old lord who we met way back in season one. I just like, I find it hard to believe that somebody has that much power. But I guess when all your troops are only loyal to one guy, no matter how old and screwed up he is, it kind of makes a difference. But being a naive, I guess, non-military, you know, non-political guy, I guess I don't have anything in my life that I can relate to it with.
You're not alone.
Yeah.
You're not alone. So I'm kind of with you on that. People don't fight for Rob, and I'm like, why would you fight for the guy that you fight for?
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of a jerk.
Yeah, yeah. But you and I, Lou. Team Rob.
Exactly.
Well, I guess we can move on to the highlight of the show, which I think is more politics, but politics with some venom attached, and that is the namesake of the episode, The Climb, which is a conversation between Varys and Littlefinger. This is easily my favorite scene of the show, possibly my favorite quote and kind of scene of the season so far.
Yeah, this was kind of epic.
Oh, man.
I was kind of taken aback by the whole situation because I was like, wow, these two spy masters kind of dig into each other. And then it's like they leave each other and it's like, I don't know how I should feel about this whole situation.
Yeah, it's one thing that we know about Varys from previous episodes is that he's a very patient person. So, I mean, having his creator, the guy that made him a eunuch, kind of shipped from overseas after I don't know how many years, 30 years or something like that, and he finally has his vengeance. Like, that's patience. And I feel like he is tolerating Littlefinger only because Littlefinger hasn't figured how to snuff Varys out yet, and he knows that. Like, Varys
right.
is aware that he's still safe, so he's just like, well, you've thwarted my plans. Some people have died. More people have died. More people will die. But I can wade through that. Like, I can wade through your muck and still come out on top. He's still disgusted and, you know, kind of not, well, he's taken aback, I guess, a little bit. But it's just, it's really, I don't know, it's just, I feel like it, the conversation back and forth was like you said, you these two spy masters, I equated it to puppet masters. Like,
yeah, yeah.
They're both pulling the strings at the same time, and he's like, you know, watch me pull this string, but I have this string over here, but did you know that I had this string? And it's just, it's all very dark with Littlefinger. He is kind of like, just kind of going off the deep end with a smile.
Yeah, they really make you realize that Littlefinger is not what he has seemed to be for the last few seasons.
Yeah, I mean, like, no one, you don't, you never like him. You're like, you know he's up to no good, but you always kind of pegged him as a small player.
Right.
Right? And it's only recently where he's been given Harrenhal, and he's going to be trying to wed Lysa Arryn to get the Eyrie, and then he's going along with Tywin Lannister's plans. Like, as soon as Tywin entered the capital, I feel like Littlefinger, his power started to grow, or at least his confidence started to grow. And I don't know whether it's because he's gained favor with the king and queen regent, or whether it's because he's gained favor with Tywin. I haven't quite sorted it out.
In the books and also in the show, I always feel like they're doing this to him like they think it's a punishment. And it's almost like he's convinced them to punish him with the things he wants.
Yeah, good call. Good call. That, yeah, that's exactly how I would put it too.
Because when he makes a reference to having to marry Lysa Arryn, it's like, ugh. But it's like, is he saying ugh because he doesn't like her? Or is it because he wants them to think they're punishing him and feel bad for him, but it's really what he wants in the long run?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you really start to see how dangerous he is because he's been so underestimated.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, what he did, I mean, obviously, he found out that Roz was speaking with Varys, and he had spoken to her before. When Roz was really upset about the infant being killed, the one that was Robert's bastard.
Right
in front of everybody, she was really upset by it, and he basically threatened her by saying, there are men out there that would pay a lot of money to do things with you that you wouldn't like, and I'm here to stand between you and those men, because in the long run you're a good investment, but if you prove to be a bad investment, then I'll just cut my losses, take a hit with the money long term, but get a big bang short term and give you these nasty people. And I kind of made sense of that all when it happened. What I didn't realize until I just, at the very, very moment that they showed Joffrey, that I realized that Joffrey was one of those people.
Right.
I mean, you get a sense of it when he molests the girls that Tyrion sends him, but you almost felt that that was a stab at his uncle, not that it was something he was truly enjoying.
Right.
Right. I mean, he likes the power, but it wasn't like really, really dark.
You always feel like the king is kind of an idiot, and he lords over everything, and he doesn't have any real power, but he thinks he does. But then they show you that scene, and it's like, no, maybe it isn't a good idea that he's the king, because he's gonna do bad things.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really bad things. So
yeah,
I mean,
like. He's even more twisted than you thought he was.
Yeah, I mean, and killing Roz with a crossbow while she's strung up on his bed is just like, and I mean, there's more than one crossbow bolt in her, and you know that the first one wasn't the one in her heart. You know,
right.
Like, just, oh, really kind of, because I liked Roz. I mean, I know that she was a secondary character and that she was a whore and whatever, but there's something about her character that I enjoyed. You know, like, she was kind of, like, self-made and doing the best with what she had. And
exactly,
you know,
exactly.
Like,
she was always a character I was fond of.
Yeah,
it was
and
like,
she was funny.
Exactly.
Yeah, she had, I mean, between her and Tyrion, even in the first season, there were some funny exchanges there. So we just, it was kind of, he's like, God, you little bastard child king.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not to mention, you know, of course, Littlefinger for putting her in that situation to begin with. But, or I guess Varys for coaxing her into telling him stuff with no real regard for what he knew would happen if Littlefinger found out.
I think even he seems like he was taken back, like, oh crap, how did he even figure out what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, well, I think it was a double, I think it was the double cross. It was the, it was the conversation with Tywin and Orlena that pieced it all together, I think, where Tywin and Orlena knew each other's plots and they shouldn't have.
Right.
And it's the only reason and the only hole that I think Littlefinger could figure out, and the only person that was present at those kind of, I guess, the makings of those arrangements was probably Roz.
Right.
I mean, I'd have to comb footage to figure it out, but that seems like
I think you're right.
The logical choice. At any rate, the conversation led to one of my favorite quotes, and Varys is talking about this whole idea of the realm and keeping kind of the general peace of things. And, you know, if we abandon it, it's a lie, you know, and what's left, you know, chaos, a pit, a gaping pit waiting to swallow us all. And Littlefinger just says, chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. And I thought that was just bang on for what this show is all about.
Right. And it also makes you realize, oh, he has way bigger intentions than you think of if he wants to bring the realm to total chaos.
Well, man, and he is just beginning. Because, I mean, we haven't seen him really do anything super vile outside of turn Stark over to the authorities. That's the only thing that he really did that you don't like him for. But he didn't kill Stark himself. You know, like, he didn't do any of that. He just let the other people handle it. This is the first sort of situation where he is really kind of pulling some darker strings and obviously has a lot more at stake, I guess. But yeah, anyway, so that's it for this episode. Do you have any final thoughts, my friend?
No, I don't. I think we covered everything.
Wow, cool. It almost swallowed the whole show, as a matter of fact, but we can march on. We can soldier on to some other things. I did see Iron Man 3. I know Peyton has seen it as well, but because he's not here, I'm just going to skip it. And it is only a week after opening night, so we'll save our Iron Man 3 thoughts for another evening. But if you've seen it, tune in to the next show, and we'll share some thoughts about the latest Marvel blockbuster event. What have you been watching, Lou? Anything besides Game of Thrones and Walking Dead?
Well, I've been watching a show that I thought I was going to hate. I'm a huge mystery fan on top of liking zombies. And Sherlock Holmes has always been a fascination of mine.
Oh, nice.
And so the BBC did Sherlock a few years ago.
Wonderful show.
And I love that show.
Great show.
And then CBS announced they were going to do their own Sherlock show.
Oh, no.
And Sherlock is played by Johnny Lee Miller. He did Hackers. And he did the TV show Eli Stone, if you're familiar with that. He's a British actor, and he's done a lot of indie stuff.
Hmm.
He's a really good actor, one of my favorites, actually.
Hmm.
And they said he was going to play Sherlock, and Watson was going to be played by Lucy Liu. And I went, no interest, this is dumb.
Yeah.
And one night I was sitting around trying to find something to watch, and I went, you know, I found the first episode online. I should really, before I make a judgment, I should watch it.
That's how they get you, Lou.
It is. And I watched the first episode, and I wasn't totally sold. I liked his character, and I liked her character.
Hmm.
But it seemed like it was kind of this generic murder of the week, Sherlock saves the day kind of thing. And it is for like the first 4 or 5 episodes. But then they start weaving in his backstory and all the things about Sherlock you don't know before the show begins, because the show takes place in New York City, and he's come to New York City because he needed drug rehab. He was a junkie.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucy Liu plays Watson, who is his counselor, to help his sobriety counselor, to help him get through being cleaning up his act. And it's like, she's always questioning him, are you using drugs? And it's like, no, will you leave me alone? And it's like, they do such a good job of making him seem really smart, but he's such an ass that you're like, I really like him, but he's such a jerk. I don't know if I would take his crap.
Yeah, he's like that in the British Sherlock, too.
It's even more so in the American version.
Like, oh, really?
If you've ever watched the show House.
Yes, yep.
He's Sherlock as House.
Okay.
And it's like you like him, And he they make you redeem his character, and you're like, you know, he did a good thing there. And then he'll be like, that person was a schmuck. And you'll be like, but that guy just helped you. and they always introduce clever things that you wouldn't think of. I've really enjoyed the show. They've got 21 episodes out now, and they get great celebrity guests.
Oh, cool.
One of the regular guests that's been in two or three episodes is he's a British actor. I can only think of him from the movie Snatch. He played Bullet Tooth Tony.
Is that Jason Statham?
Not Jason Statham, but the other guy that's really tall.
Oh,
he used to be a soccer player.
Yeah, Need for Speed?
He was in X-Men 3. He played the Juggernaut.
Yes, I know exactly who you mean. He was in Gone in 60 Seconds as well.
Yes.
I do know who you mean. I don't remember his name, but I think we've pegged the actor that I think, yeah.
It's exactly who you think it is. And he plays a villain for several episodes with Sherlock.
Mm.
And it's really clever what they do with it.
Yeah. Well, it's really funny with him too, because he's a big son of a gun. And then to hear him with this very proper British accent come out of him is very weird.
Yeah, and they're the only two really regular British characters in the show, because Johnny Lee Miller usually does an American accent, and they got him using his British accent, real British voice.
Okay.
So it's the two of them talking British, and everybody else is speaking English with an American accent. And you're like, it's weird to have them in a scene with people. But the show's really well written.
Well,
I mean,
that's
the first few episodes are a little rough, because I think they were afraid the show wasn't going to get picked up, so they were afraid to take risks. And then about four episodes in, they went, "Oh, what the hell? Let's just go with it all."
Nice. I mean, I'm a sucker for a mystery, and my dad is a big Sherlock fan, so I'll have to forward this on to him to see whether he gets it or not. I don't have cable, so I don't often have a chance to get this kind of stuff. If I do, I usually have to somehow find it either via Netflix.
It's been pretty easy for me to find online. It's on CBS here in the U.S.
Oh, we might be able to find something in Canada. They do the same thing with Grey's Anatomy, where it's like the day after you can watch the episode online or
something.
Right,
that's how I've been watching it.
Okay, cool. Now I will definitely have to check that out.
I make cord cutter as well, so.
Yeah, I have a CTV app on the iPad that allows me to AirPlay things up to the television. So I might be able to watch it like the day after, but then not have to sit and watch it on like an iPad or a computer screen. I might be able to toss it up on the big screen, which would be cooler. Interesting. I shall make a mental note. Well, I don't really have much to report. I've been watching some reruns and stuff, but nothing really big. I haven't completed a full season yet of whatever I've been watching. So I'm going to reserve my judgment and comments for that kind of...
I will just say one thing. I was glad to hear last week that you've been watching Arrow.
Oh, dude, we're done. We have one episode to down. No, tonight is the new episode, and then I have to figure out how to get a hold of it tomorrow because we are hooked on that show.
I told you it was good.
Yeah, you did. You absolutely did. And it was just a time thing. It was like, you know, it wasn't until my birthday weekend where I said, you know what? I'm taking 3 days off. I'm going to relax. And I thought, I'm bored. I am on the go all the time, and I needed something to just kind of chill out with. Jocelyn was at work, and I watched a couple episodes, and that turned into six episodes, and I just kind of sat her down and was like, all right, here, watch this. Catch up, and then let's finish it.
Exactly.
And she watched one or two, and then she just kind of jumped to where I was in the season, because it really, she kind of skipped the couple Monster of the Week episodes, not Monster, but like Villain of the Week. Because once episode like 8 or 10 happened, then the whole like season long plot is what was kind of always ongoing.
Yeah, it's something I've noticed with a lot of shows that are on their first season this year is they were really afraid that they were going to get canceled.
Mm.
And so they didn't want to invest too much into the story if the show was going to get canceled, and they were going to have to try and wrap it up in two episodes to make the fans happy.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I haven't, since then, I haven't really watched much. You know, some YouTube videos here and some trailers there. We actually have a couple of small YouTube videos later on in the internet picks. But one thing I have been doing is in the morning with my coffee, I've been reading a birthday gift that I received from my buddy Chris Hemsworth, who draws And Then They Died. It's an online comic you can find at andthentheydied.com. I think the title of the comic is actually Last Words, but it's andthentheydied.com is the website. And he gave me The iPad for Artists by Danny Jones. And Danny is another webcomic artist. She does My Sister the Freak, which is like a graphic novel style comic. And she wrote this book about drawing on the iPad, which she absolutely loves to do. And I have one. I have a hand-me-down iPad 2. I have a stylus for it, and I've been messing around with doing some digital painting and whatnot. And I have to say, the book is really well done. Danny has always been a talented reviewer. I read her blog for reviews on all kinds of things, software, drawing tools, whatever. But if you were an iPad owner and you are a doodler, then this book is worth checking out. It's under $20 for the hard copy on Amazon. And there are, of course, digital PDF versions available from Danny herself, I think, on her web store. I think it's just DaniJones.com, DaniJones.com. If not, then just look up My Sister the Freak and you'll be able to find her stuff. But it's worth checking out because she gives some very basic tips. She starts at the very beginning. I'm still kind of just getting into the meat of the book where she starts to get into more technique stuff. But if you're just getting going, it's a really easy way to start kind of messing around with digital drawing tools because, of course, the iPad makes it very intuitive when you're using like your finger or a stylus or something. So I recommend it, and I will, of course, report back on it when I'm done reading. But that's it for the main section. Mr. Lou Page, what is your pick for this week?
My pick for this week is the Ender's Game trailer.
Fantastic.
Have you watched it?
I have, sir.
Are you a fan of the book?
Don't kill me. I have not read the book.
Okay. Well, don't read the book before you see the movie then. If you haven't seen it now, just wait till the movie.
Just wait till the movie, huh?
Yeah. Because it's one of those stories that it is big twists. And if you read the book, the big twist will be gone when you watch the movie. And I'll be curious what your opinion will be if you see the movie.
Okay.
If you haven't read the book.
Sounds good. Well, Jocelyn has read the entire series.
I've tried. I'm halfway through.
She was admitting that the last one that she just actually finished up was a slog. She didn't really particularly like that, but she liked the first one a lot.
There's a lot of them. Like the Ender's Game, there's like a trilogy, and then I will admit I'm not a fan of the author's politics and his view on lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
He's very opinionated and he's kind of a jerk, but he writes fantastic books, and there's a lot of them. Like that universe, there's like 20 books in that universe.
Wow, that's crazy.
And it's like, he always says, I'm not going to write anymore in this universe. And then like 3 or 4 years down the road, he'll be like, here's another book in that universe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when the paycheck is rolling in,
exactly.
I can see that motivation. What is your opinion of the cast so far?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Like,
Jocelyn's excited too.
I knew that Harrison Ford was going to be the general. That was one of the big announcements when they started the filming.
That was the first thing I ever heard about this was the Harrison Ford connection.
And yeah, that was a lot of firsts for a lot of people with this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no idea that what's his name that plays the Mandarin was even in the movie. So when his
Ben Kingsley.
Mm-hmm. I saw him in the trailer, I was like, I didn't even know he was in this.
Well, when we went to go see Iron Man yesterday, Jocelyn was talking about Ben Kingsley's performance on the way home, and she was racking her brain. She's like, I know he's in another big blockbuster movie, and I know he's a villain, and I can't place it. And it wasn't until we watched the Ender's Game trilogy where she's like, or the trailer, she's like, oh, he's not a villain, but he plays a really serious character. And that's the glimpse that she remembers him from, was that she knew he was going to be in this movie. And she didn't see the trailer before we watched it together, but she knew the character he played. And she was like, oh, he's perfect. Like, she was really stoked about that.
I'm really curious as what they're going to do with it, because there's a lot of the book. It's a very wordy book.
Mm.
Like, there's whole chapters that take place in characters' heads.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making a movie out of this. So I'm really curious as to see what they're going to do to explain to you character motivations.
Interesting.
Like, it's not going to spoil anything, but in the book, he plays a game, and it's basically described as like a point-and-click adventure game that helps them all adjust to life on that space station.
Okay.
And he's the only one that keeps playing it after they get there. And he plays it throughout the whole book, and he keeps advancing where other players have given up.
Oh, interesting.
And it's just this weird little subplot. that takes place in the book, and it, I'm like, they're gonna have to leave that behind when they do the movie, because we're not gonna, they're not gonna have people wanting to watch him play a point and click adventure game for 20 minutes of a movie.
the Doogie Howser moment at his computer console at the end of the day.
Exactly. You know,
that's funny. There was one other question I had about that. Oh, I noticed a tweet online today about Ender's Game. Someone was comparing it and saying that it looked an awful lot like Halo.
Yes.
You think so? Okay. I wasn't sure.
The art style, like it looks like they're borrowing. It doesn't look like it's going. It doesn't look exactly like the Halo universe, but it looks like they've borrowed some of the art style.
Some of the art direction. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. I like the Halo stuff.
It's pretty.
Yeah. Well, it's shiny. It's space. You know, it's all good. Well, my stuff, or my pick this week, I guess, is on the opposite side of the spectrum. It is not sci-fi, it is fantasy, it is not video games, it is good old-fashioned toys. I was introduced to The Battle of Helm's Deep as told with Lego by Jez Tuya. Jez, I hope I am pronouncing your name correctly. His Twitter handle is Jez_Tuya, T-U-Y-A. And he sent me this video of the Battle for Helm's Deep as told by Lego figurines in stop motion animation. And it is freaking hilarious.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Basically, it's a simple plot. Early on in Helm's Deep, there's a little joke between Legolas and Gimli, which is in the movie, about Legolas saying, "Do you want me to find you a box so you can see over the battlement?" And they basically take this the length of the whole battle in this particular rendition of the battle. It is, I don't know how long it is, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, whatever it is, it's totally worth your time. Go watch it. The link will be in the show notes. We've got it here in the live chat room as well. And it is hilarious. I had a really good chuckle over this the other day. So much appreciate the retweet, Mr. Tuya. And I don't know, everybody, write us and let us know what you think about this Lego stuff. We've been having a lot of Lego things on the show lately. And if you've got a cool Lego site or a cool Lego project or video that you want to share, send it our way. I was at actually the video game store the other day, and there was a sale, 2 games for $20. And I found one game I wanted, but I couldn't find another game I wanted. So I didn't really want to pay like $14 or $19.99 for one game when I could just wait until I find one I want. Anyway, the game that I had in my hand was Lego Star Wars Saga, the whole thing.
Yeah, and that's a hard find, by the way.
Yeah, for $10, I was like, God damn it. Anyway, yeah, I'm on a budget. I'm trying not to buy things I don't need right now, but it's just like, oh, I know that I would enjoy every last minute of this.
It's a fantastic game. I have a copy floating around here somewhere.
Nice, nice. Yeah, well, it is definitely on the radar for Joss and I. Ultimately, we decided on Red Dead Redemption, the Game of the Year edition. Which neither one of us had played. We know that there's probably not many people playing it now, but we figured the single-player story would be worth the $18 we played.
I'll be honest. That's a fantastic game. Multiplayer, I didn't enjoy.
Okay. Well, then maybe we're not missing out on anything.
Yeah, you're probably not missing out on much.
All right. Cool. Well, if it's okay with you, sir, I think it's time to wrap up the show. We've gone a little bit long, but all well worth it when the zombie lord is on the podcast. If you were paying attention at the top of the show, it is Wednesday night. We record the Citadel Cafe every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern. You can tune in live on joelduggan.com. There's a live window right there. Also a live chat room, should you want to stop by and say hello. Music for the cafe is composed by Kevin MacLeod, and the podcast is, of course, available on demand via iTunes and our website, thecitadelcafe.com. That is also where you can find the show notes. Feel free to contact the show, thecitadelcafe@gmail.com, or hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, or Google+, with just the show name, The Citadel Cafe. Don't forget to tune in to our friends on the Gamers In podcast every Friday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern on amove.tv. You can join Jocelyn and Ryan on their Friday evenings as they talk about all the cool gaming stuff and gaming news that has happened over the last week. It's been pretty light on the news lately, but Jocelyn and Ryan are very passionate about video games, and they have no trouble filling an hour-long show about all the cool things that are happening. I feel like Jocelyn is probably going to be talking some Red Dead, and I know that both of them have been going through their Steam library, so there might be some interesting smaller titles coming up on the new show this Friday night. As I mentioned at the top of the show, my name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am up to online at joelduggan.com, including my book, Starcrossed Volume 1, which is available in my web store. And tune in to the store over the next few weeks as there are going to be some special announcements for some unique things that are going to become available to you. T-shirts. And that's it for me. Lou, where can people find you online? What's the podcast address? What's your Twitter? Give them the deals.
Well, first, let's start with Twitter. You can find me at BusyZombieLord on Twitter. You can find my show at ZombiesAteMyPodcast.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, all that fun stuff. And if you're interested in my writing, I actually do some writing on the side. I write for a website called Games Are Evil. And I occasionally, and I promise I'll have a new article soon, I do article blog posts on the Gamers Inn website. So.
Ooh. Well, I guess, spoiler alert, I am working with Ryan and Jocelyn behind the scenes to redesign the site. So your blog posts might be easier seen and readily available when we all have the time to sit down and hash that out. So looking forward to it, man. I'm going to have to look up some of the stuff that you've written on Games Are Evil. That sounds like a fun blog.
They're a very niche site. They don't specialize in the mainstream stuff. They write a lot about smaller stuff that people don't pay attention to. So,
which I know very little about. So that probably be all news to me.
I specialize in their history section. I write about old games.
Oh, neat.
That's kind of my forte. So
very cool. Very, very cool. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two. You've been listening to the Gamers in. No, you haven't. I've got gaming on the brain.
This is TCC.
This is TCC. This isn't the Gamers Inn. I'm not even a host on Gamers Inn. I guess I'm just trying to plug the crap out of Jocelyn's show.